Welcome to the Reality Revolution. I'm your host, Brian Scott. I got a new one for you today. It's going to be a lot of fun to read. It's very powerful and really surprising how much it links to what we've been talking about. I found this author, Alexander McIver Tyndall. You may have listened to my previous episode. I don't know if I'm going to release this one first or not. But this guy has a sort of history in the New Thought movement. Was a hypnotist, wrote a book called Ghosts, A Message from the Illuminati, and may have been a part of a secret society and had unique hypnotic powers. And so there's some interesting information about him. And he wrote in a pseudonym under the name Ali Nomad for this amazing discussion of illumination, which is what people talk about the Illuminati, but in particular, the way of illumination, how we become illuminated. And there's an amazing book called The Way of Illumination and Cosmic Consciousness, The Man God Whom We Await, The Lives of Prophetic and Spiritual Figures, Ancient and Modern. I highly suggest that you read the book. It has a description of illumination, discussion of the self, and a variety of other different concepts, and then goes into detail about Moses, Gautama, Jesus of Nazareth, Paul of Tarsus, Muhammad, Swedenborg, gives examples of poets and a bunch of people that have seen illumination, had the light given to them, how they've changed their lives. And it's really a description in my own heart of what would happen if we went into a new earth, sort of spiritual awakening. And there's a chapter at the end on methods of attainment, the way of illumination. And I wanted to read a few references from this book, but I recommend you read the whole thing. And we're going to read the discussion, the argument at the beginning with a beautiful poem about illumination, the awakening of illumination, and then the methods of attainment. The self and symbol. Thou most divine, above all women, above all men in consciousness, thou in thy nearness to me hast shown me paths of love, yea, walks that lead from hell to the great light where life and love do ever reign. Thou hast taught me a patience to behold whatever state, however beautiful and joyful, however ugly and sorrowful, to know that these are all but the glimmerings of the greater life, expressions of the infinite, according to the finality of that moment, now to come in the eternal now, which thou sweet presence hast awakened me to. I see the light, the way, an everlasting illumination that takes me to the gate, the open door, to the house of God. There, I find most priceless jewels, the key to all the ways that lead from Om to Thee, a mistake, an off turn from the apparent road of right, is but the bruising of Thy temple, calling Thyself Thy soul, the God within, showing Thee the nita of it all, which is but half of me. And as thy consciousness of the two, the nita and the ita, comes to thee, a three is formed, the trinity is found. Through thee the deity has spoken, uniting the two in the one, revealing the illusion of mortality, the message of Om to the illumined. Man is essentially a spiritual being. The source of this spiritual omniscience we may not, in our finite intelligence, fully cognize, because full cognition would preclude the possibility of finite expression. The destiny of man is perfection. Man perfected becomes a god. Only the gods are immortal, we are told. Let us consider what this means, supposing it to be an axiom of truth. Mortality is subject to change and death. Mortality is the manifest, the stage upon which man in his life plays many parts. Immortality is what the word says it is, godhood recognized in the mortal. I'm or Om, the more general term, stands for the changeless, birthless, deathless, unnameable power that holds the words in space and puts intelligence into men. Biologists, even though they were to succeed in reproducing life by chemical processes from so-called lifeless sterilized matter, making so high a form of manifestation as man himself, yet could never name the power by which they accomplished it. Always there must remain the unknowable, the absolute. Om, therefore, is the word we use to express this omniscient, omnipotent, and omnipresent power. The term mortal we have already defined. The compound immortal, applied to individual man, stands for one who has made his at-one-ment with Om, and who has, while still in the mortal body, recognized himself as one with Om. This is what it means to escape the second death, to which the merely mortal consciousness is subject. This is the goal of every human life. This is the essence, the substance of all religious systems and all philosophies. The only chance for disputation among theologians and philosophers lies in the way of accomplishing this at-one-ment. There is not the slightest opportunity for a difference of opinion as what they wish to accomplish. Admitting then that the goal of every soul is the same, immortality, the mortal consciousness cognizing itself as Om, we come to a consideration of the evidence we may find in support of this axiom. This evidence we do not find satisfactory in spirit communication, in psychic experiences, in hypnotic phenomena, and astral trips, important and reliable as these many psychic research phenomena are. These are not satisfactory or convincing evidences of our at-one-ment with Om, because they do not preclude the probability of the second death, but on the contrary, they verify it. However, aside from all these psychic phenomena, there is a phase of human experience, much more rare but becoming somewhat general, that transcends phenomena of every kind. The Western world has given to these experiences the term cosmic consciousness, which term is self-explanatory. The Orientals have long known of this goal of the soul, and they have terms to express this, varying with the many types of the Oriental mind, but all meaning the same thing. This meaning, from our Occidental viewpoint, is best translated in the term liberation, signifying to be set free from the limitations of sense and of self-consciousness, and to have glimpsed the larger area of consciousness that takes in the very cosmos. This experience is accompanied by a great light. Whether this light is manifested as spiritual or as intellectual power determines its expression. The object of this is to call attention to some of the more pronounced instances of this illumination and to classify them according as they have been expressed through religious enthusiasm, poetical fervor, or great intellectual power. But we have also one other argument to make, and this we present with the conviction of its truth. While conceding that it must remain a theory until proven, each individual man or woman for himself and herself, the postulate is this: immortality, i.e. godhood, is bisexual. No male person can by any possibility become an immortal god in, of, and by himself. No female person can be complete without the other half that makes the one. Each and every soul, therefore, has its spiritual counterpart, its other half, with which it unites on the spiritual plane when the time comes for attainment of immortality. Sex is an eternal verity. The entire cosmos is bisexual. Everything in the visible universe, in the manifest, is the result of this universal principle. As above, so below, is a safe rule as far as the idea goes. This hypothesis does not preclude perfection above of that which we find below, but any radical reversion or repudiation of nature is inconceivable. Male and female created he them. This being true, male and female must they return to the source from which they sprung, completing the circle, and gaining what? Consciousness of godhood, of completeness in counterpartal union. not absorption of consciousness, but union, which is quite a different idea. Out of this counterpartal union, a race of gods will be born, and these supermen shall inherit the earth, making it a fit dwelling place for the gods. This earth is now being made fit. This fact may seem a far distant hope if we do not judge with the eyes of the seer, but its proof lies in the emancipation of woman. Its evidences are many and varied, but the awakening of woman is the cause. This awakening of woman constitutes the first rays of the dawn, that long looked for millennium, which many of us have regarded as a mere figure of speech, instead of as a literal truth. The argument is not that there has been no individual awakening until the present time, but that never before in the finite history of the world has there been such a general awakening, and as it is self-evident that conditions will reflect the idea of the majority, the fact that woman is being given her rightful place in the sense consciousness life proves that the earth will be a fit dwelling place for a higher order of beings than have hitherto constituted the majority. The numerous instances of illumination or cosmic consciousness which are forcing attention at the present time prove that there is a race awakening to a realization of our unity with Om. Another point which we trust these pages will make clear is this so-called revelation is neither a personal discovery nor any special act of a divine power. God spake thus and so to me is a phrase which the self-conscious initiate employs because he has lost sight of the cosmic light or because he finds it expedient to use that phraseology in delivering the message of cosmic consciousness. If we will substitute the term initiation for the term revelation, we will have a clear idea of the truth. Perhaps some of our readers will feel the terms mean the same, but for the most part, those who have employed the word revelation have used it as implying the plan of the cosmos was unfinished, and that the Creator, having found some person suitable to convey the latest decision to mankind, natural laws had been suspended and the revelation made. It is to correct this view that we emphasize the distinction between the two worlds. Cosmos is complete. As it was in the beginning, it is now and ever shall be. Worlds without end. A circle is without beginning or end. We, in our individual consciousness, may traverse this circle, but our failure to realize its completeness does not change the fact that it is finished. We cannot add to the universal consciousness nor take away therefrom. But we can extend our own area of consciousness from the narrow limits of the personal self into the heights and depths of the Atman, who shall set limitations to the power of the Atman, the higher self, when it has attained it at one-ment with Om. It is not the purpose of this book to race the spiritual ascent of man's further than to point on the wide gulf between the degrees of consciousness manifested in the lower animals and that of human consciousness, again tracing in the human the ever-widening area of his cognition of the personal self and its needs to be awakening of the soul and its needs which needs to include the welfare of all living things as an absolute necessity to individual happiness. Altruism, therefore, is not a virtue. It is a means of self-preservation. Without this degree of initiation into the boundless area of universal or cosmic consciousness, we may not escape the karmic law. The revelations, therefore, upon which are founded the numerous religious systems are comparable with that many and various degrees of initiation into that which is. They represent the degree which the initiate has taken in the lodge. It may be argued that this fact of individual initiation into the ever-present truth of being as into a lodge offers no proof that this earth is to ultimately become a heaven. It may be that this planet is the outermost lodge room and that there will never be a sufficient number of initiates to make the earth a fit dwelling place for a higher order of beings that now inhabit it. This may indeed be true, but all evidence tends towards the hope that even the planet itself will come under the regenerating power of illumination. All prophecies embody this promise. All that we know of what materialists call evolution and occultists might well name uncovering of consciousness points to a time when God's will shall be done on earth as it is in heaven. All who have attained to cosmic consciousness in whatever degree have prophesied a time when this blessing would descend upon every one. But the difficulty in adequately explaining the great gift seems also to have been the burden of their cry. Jesus sought repeatedly to describe to his hearers that wonders of the cosmic sense, but realized that he was too far in advance of the cyclic end. But even as it at that time a number of the disciples were capable of receiving the illumination, so today a larger number are capable of attainment. If this number is great enough to bring about the regeneration, the perfecting of the earth condition, then it must be accomplished. We believe that it is. We make the claim that millennium has dawned, and although it may be years before the light of the morning breaks into the full light of the day, yet the rays of dawn are dispelling the world's long night. In his powerful and prophetic story, In the Days of the Comet, H.G. Wells tells of a great change that comes over the world following an atmospheric phenomenon in which a green vapor is generated in the clouds and falls upon the earth with instantaneous effect. Side note, maybe I need to read that for the podcast. As this peculiar vapor descends, it has the effect of putting everyone to sleep. This sleep continues for 3 days, and when people finally awake, their interior nature has undergone a complete change. Where before they saw dimly, they now see clearly. The petty differences and quarrels are perceived in their true perspective. Instead of place and power and influence and wealth being all-important goals of ambition, as before the change, everyone now strives to be of service to the world. Love and kindness becomes greater factors than commercial expediency and business success. In many respects, Wells' description of the great change and its effect upon people corresponds with the effect of illumination. The sense of entering into the very heart of things, of growing plants, the birds, and the little wood animals, the intense sympathy an understanding of life described by him sounds like the effect of cosmic consciousness, as related by nearly all who have attained it. How the world's activities are resumed after the change, and under what vastly different incentives people work, form a part of the story which is written as fiction, but which contains the seeds of a great truth. This truth is expressed in science as human achievement, and in religion as fulfilled prophecy, but the truth is the same. Both religion and science point to a time when this earth will know freedom from strife and suffering. Even the elements which have hitherto been regarded as beyond the boundaries of man's will may be completely controlled. Not maybe, but will be. Manual labor will cease. Societies will put a stop to war when they come to the inevitable conclusion that no race can by any possibility be improved, while the most perfect physical species are reserved for armies. Awakening women will refuse, indeed they are now refusing, to bear children, to be shot down in warfare and crushed under the juggernaut of commercial competition. Those who realize the signs of the times look for the birth of cosmic consciousness as a race consciousness foreshadowing the new day, the second coming of Christ, not as a personal vicarious sacrifice, but as a factor in human attainment. "For I am persuaded," said St. Paul, "that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor any other creature shall be able to separate us from the love of God." If we interpret this in the light of cosmic consciousness, we realize that we shall know and experience that boundless, deathless, perfect, satisfying, complete, and all-embracing love, which is the goal of immortality, which is an attribute, we may say, the one attribute of God. We are not looking for the birth of a Christ child, but of the Christ child. We are not looking for a second coming of a man who shall be as Jesus was, but we are anticipating the coming of the man who shall be cosmically conscious, even as Jesus, or as was Gautama the Buddha. That there may be one man and one woman who shall first achieve this consciousness and realization is barely possible, but the preponderance of evidence is for a more general awakening to the light of illumination. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed in the twinkling of an eye, said St. Paul. The prophecy of the woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet is not of a woman, but of a woman, in the light of a race of men who have attained cosmic consciousness. Nothing more is needed to make a heaven of earth than the great light and love that comes of illumination shall become dominant. It will solve all problems, because problems arise only because we are groping in the dark. The elimination of selfishness, of condemnation, of fear and anger and doubt must have far greater power for universal happiness and well-being than all the systems which theology of science or politics could devise. Indeed, all these systems are sporadic and empirical attempts to express the vague dawning of illumination. In the fullness of its light, the need for systems will have passed away. Like Lord Buddha, the Indian sage Sri Ramakrishna describes his experience of illumination as one of unbounded light. Speaking of this strange and overpowering sense of being immersed in light, Sri Ramakrishna described it thus: the living light to which the earnest devotee is drawn doth not burn. It is like the light coming from a gem, shining yet soft, cool, and soothing. It burneth not. It giveth peace and joy. This effect of great light is an almost invariable accompaniment of superconsciousness, although there are instances of undoubted cosmic consciousness in which the realization has been a more gradual growth, rather than a sudden influx in which the phenomenon of light is not greatly marked. Muhammad is said to have swooned with intolerable splendor of the flood of white light which broke upon him after many days of constant prayer and meditation in the solitude of the cavern outside of the gates of Mecca. Similar is the description of the attainment of cosmic consciousness given by the Persian mystics, although it is evident that the Sufis regarded the result as reunion with the other half of the soul in exile. The burden of their cry is love, and union with the beloved is the longed-for goal for all earthly strife and experience. Whether this reunion be considered from the standpoint of finding the other half of the perfect one, as exemplified in the present-day search for the soul mate, or whether it be considered in the light of a spiritual merging into the one eternal absolute, is the question of questions. Certainly the terms used to express this state of spiritual ecstasy are words which might readily be applied to lovers united in marriage. One thing is certain, the Sufis did not personify the deity except symbolically, and the beloved one is impartially referred to as masculine or feminine, even as modern thought has come to realize God as the father-mother. In all mystical writings, we find the conclusion, there is no one way in which the seeker may find reunion with the beloved. The ways of God are as the number of the souls of men, declare the followers of Islam, and for the love that thou wouldst find demands the sacrifice of self to the end that the heart may be filled with the passion to stand within the Holy of Holies, in which alone the mysteries of the true beloved can be revealed unto thee, is also a Sufi sentiment, although it might also be Christian or Mohammedan or Vedantin. Indeed, if the student of esotericism searches deeply enough, he will find a surprising unity of sentiment and even of expression in all the varieties of religions and philosophies, including Christianity. It has been said that the chief difference between the message of Jesus and those of the holy men of other races and times lies in the fact that Jesus, more than his predecessors, emphasized the importance of love. But consider the following lines from Jami, the Persian mystic: gaze till gazing out of gazing grew to being her. I gazed on, she and I no more, but in one, undivided being blended. All that is not one must ever suffer with the wound of absence, and whoever in love's city enters finds but room for one, and but in oneness union. These lines express the religious ecstasy which results from spiritual aspiration, or they express the union of the individual soul with its mate according to the viewpoint. In any event, they are an excellent description of the realization of that much to be desired consciousness, which is fittingly described in Occidental phraseology as cosmic consciousness. Whether this realization is the result of union with the soul's other half, or whether it is an impersonal reunion with the causeless cause, the absolute from which we are earth wanderers is not the direct purpose of this volume to answer, though the question will be answered, and that soon. The riddle of the Sphinx is no riddle at all. The strange figure, the lower part animal, the upper part human, and the sprouting wings epitomize the growth and development of man from the animal or physical carnal consciousness to the soul consciousness represented by woman's head and breast to the superconscious winged God. No higher conception of life has ever emanated from any source than the concept of man developed to a state of perfection represented by wings, a symbol of freedom. These winged humans are sometimes called angels and sometimes gods, although the words may not be synonymous. The point is that no theory of life and its purposes seems more general or more inescapable than that of man's growth from limitations to godhood or freedom. Whether this consummation is brought about through an unbroken chain of upward tendencies from the lowest forms of life to the highest, or whether it is symbolized by the old theologic idea of man's fall from godhood to sin, the fact remains that we know no other ideal than that represented by perfected man, and we know no lower idea than that of man still in the animal stage of consciousness. Artists, painters, sculptors wishing to depict the beauty of spiritual things must still use the human idea for a model, refined, spiritualized, superhuman, but still man. It is a truism that man epitomizes the universe. Therefore, the law of growth, which science names evolution, may be studied and applied with equal precision and accuracy to the individual, to a body of individuals called a nation, and to worlds or planets. The evolution of an individual is accomplished when he has learned through the various avenues of experience the fact of his own godhood, and when he has established his union with that indescribable spiritual essence, which is called Om, God, Nirvana, Samadhi, Brahm, Kami, Allah, and the Absolute. A Japanese term is Daizaku. The Zen sect of Japanese Buddhists say Daigo Tetai, and one who has attained this super phase of consciousness is called Shonin, meaning literally above man. Emerson, the great American seer, expressed this nameless one as the oversoul, and Herbert Spencer, the intellectual giant of England, used the term universal energy. Emerson was a seer, Spencer was a scientist, which word, until recently, was a synonym for materialist. But what are words? Mere symbols of consciousness, and subject to change and evolvement as man's consciousness evolves. The student of truth will recognize in these different words exactly the same meaning. The eternal energy from which all things proceed is a phrase identical with the oversoul or the absolute from which all manifestation comes. Man's evolution, then, is an evolution in consciousness, from the subjective awareness of the monad to a realization of the entire cosmos. Each phase of life is a specific degree of consciousness, and each successive degree brings the individual nearer to the realization of the sum of all degrees of consciousness into godhood, the highest degree which we can conceive. Such, briefly, is a statement of that phenomenon which is attracting the attention of Occidental students of psychology, and which has been fittingly termed the attainment of cosmic consciousness. The phrase expresses a degree of consciousness which includes the entire cosmos, not only this planet called Earth and everything thereon, but also the spheres of the constellation. Not that this degree of consciousness carries with it the power to express in words that which it is. In fact, the one who has had this marvelous awakening cannot adequately describe or even retain a full comprehension of what it signifies. All-inclusive knowledge would indeed preclude the possibility of expression. Therefore, even if it were possible, to retain in the finite mind the full realization of cosmic consciousness, words could not be found in which to express it to others. Thought is the creator of words, but thought is but the material which the mind employs, and cosmic consciousness transcends the mind, engulfs the soul, and reaches the trackless areas of spirit. It may be doubted if anyone may retain a full realization of cosmic consciousness and remain in the physical body. Great and wonderful as have been the experience of those who have sought to relate their sensations, it is probable that these flashes of insight have been in the nature of cosmic perception and have lacked full realization. Of those who have had glimpses of that larger area of consciousness, which includes an awareness of eternal unity with the cosmos, there are, we believe, many more than students of the subject have any idea of. This century marks a distinct epoch in what is called evolution. The end of a kalpa, or cycle of manifestation, is symbolized by the presence on a planet of many avatars, masters, and angels. By their very presence, these enlightened ones arouse in all who are ready for their experience a glimpse of that state of being to which all souls are destined and to which all shall ultimately attain, a time when gods shall walk the earth. It is a prophecy which all nations have heard and looked forward to. That time is now. We see the effect of their presence in peace conferences, in abolition of child labor, in prison reform, in the amalgamation of the races, in attempts at social equity in national societies, and above all, as we have before stated, in the emancipation of women. In fact, it has seen in all the various ways in which the higher consciousness finds expression. One of the characteristic signs of this awakening, the Millennium Dawn, as it has been named, lies in a very general optimism shining through the mists of doubt and unrest, an inexpressible desire which accompanies the new birth in consciousness. Amid the seeming chaos of present-day conditions, it is not easy to discern the coming of that dawn of which all great ones of Earth have foretold, a time when the Earth shall be made a fit habitation for the gods. The heavens is a term employed to specify the constellation which is composed of planets and stars, but we use the term heaven also to mean a state of happiness and bliss attainable through certain methods, a consideration of which we will take up soon. The immediate point is that this planet is being prepared for a position in the solar system consistent with that which is the abode of the gods, heaven. This proposition is made in its literal meaning corroborative of this statement, which is consistent with all prophecies, is the information recently given to the world by Camille Flammarion and other great astronomers that the Earth is changing its position in the heavens at an astonishing rate. The idea that there shall be no night there is foreshadowed by the estimate that this change will give to the Earth a perpetual and uniform light and heat. The new thought preachment of physical immortality is but a faint and imperfect perception of this time, when there shall be no death, because the animal man subject to change shall give place to the changeless, deathless, spiritual man, not through cataclysms and destruction, but through the natural birth into a higher consciousness. The Occidental mind is easily affrighted by a name. Perhaps we should not specify the Occidental mind, but rather the mind of man among all races is easily put to sleep by the hypnotism of a word. The word pantheism is a bugaboo to the Occidentalist. He fears the destruction of the monistic faith if he admits that man in essence is a god, and that therefore there are many gods in the one God, even as there are many members of the one physical organism. Nevertheless, all literature, whether sacred or profane, teaches the attainment of godhood by man. This cannot mean other than the attainment of realization of godhood by the individual and the retention of this realization to the end, that reincarnation shall cease and identity with cosmic principle be established beyond further loss or doubt or strife or death. This is what it means to attain to cosmic consciousness. It is inclusive consciousness. It is not absorption into the vast unknown, in the sense of annihilation of identity. It is consciousness plus, not minus. An ancient writing says, "And thou shalt awake as from a long dream. Thou shalt be like the perfume arising from the flower in which it has been so long enclosed, and thou wilt float above the open flower, and thou wilt say, there is time before me in eternity." There is nothing in the testimony of those who have described as best they could their emotions upon attainment of this consciousness, which would argue the absorption of the individual soul into the absolute. There is no testimony to argue that the attainment of cosmic consciousness carries with it anything approaching annihilation of sentiency. Rather, it would seem to testify to an acceleration of all the higher faculties. That this would be a more apt interpretation may be seen by comparing the different reports of those experiencing the phenomena of illumination. Nevertheless, this has been much controversy regarding the meaning of the terms nirvana, samadhi, etc., words expressing the condition which we are considering under the phase cosmic consciousness. The book gives a description of nirvana and some different references from yoga, Swami Vivekananda, St. Paul, regarding the state of nirvana. The key element that I wanted to bring into this was the final chapter on the methods of attainment, the way of illumination, in which different techniques, including yoga, are discussed as a way, a method of achieving the illumination that he discusses. Oriental philosophers recognize four important methods of yoga. Yoga is the word which signifies uniting with God. From what has gone before in these pages, the reader will understand that unity with God means us, the uncovering of the God nature within or above the human personality. It means the attainment and retainment in fullness of cosmic consciousness. We do not believe that anyone retains full and complete realization of cosmic consciousness and remains in the physical body. The numerous instances to which we allude in former chapters are at best but temporary flights into that state, which is the goal of the soul's pilgrimage and the only means of escape from the ceaseless round of births and deaths, which so waited upon the heart of Gautama. The paths of yoga, then, are the methods by which the mind in the personal self is made to perceive the reality of the higher self and its relation to the supreme intelligence, the absolute. The various methods or paths are pointed out, but no one, nor all of these paths, guarantees illumination as a reward for diligence. That which is in the heart of the disciple is the key that unlocks the door. These paths are called Karma Yoga, Raja Yoga, Gnani Yoga, Bhakti Yoga. Karma Yoga is the path of cheerful submission to the conditions in which the disciple finds himself, believing that those conditions are his because of his needs and in order that he may fulfill that which he has attracted to himself. The admonition, "Whatsoever thy hands finds to do, that doest thou with all thy heart," sums up the lessons of the path of Karma Yoga. The urge to achieve, to do, to accomplish, to strive, and attain actuates those who have, whether with conscious intent or because of a vague inward urge, devoted their lives to taking an active part in the material or intellectual achievements of the race. There are those who are blindly following, as far as their mental operations are concerned, the path of Karma Yoga. That is, they work without knowing why they work. They work because they are compelled to do so, as slaves of the law. These will work their way out of the necessity of fulfillment in the course of time, even though they blindly follow the urge. But if they could be made to work as masters of the conditions under which they labor, instead of as slaves to environment, they would find themselves at the end of that path. Karma Yoga would have been accomplished. Work as those work who are ambitious, but be not thou enslaved by the delusion of personal ambition. This is the password to liberation from Karma Yoga. Raja Yoga is the way of the strongly individualized will. Knowledge is power, is the hope which encourages the disciple on the path of Raja Yoga. He seeks to master the personal self by meditation, by concentration of will, by self-discipline and sacrifice. When the ego gains complete control over the mental faculties so that the mind may be directed by the individual will suggests, the student has mastered the path of Raja Yoga. If his mastery is complete, he finds himself regarding his body as the instrument of the self, and the body and its functions are under the guidance of the ego. The mind is the lever with which this self raises the consciousness from the lower to the higher vibrations. The student who has mastered Raja Yoga can induce the trance state, control his dreams as well as his waking thoughts. He may learn to practice magic in its higher aspect, but unless he is extremely careful, this power will tempt him to use his knowledge for selfish or unworthy purposes. Let the student of Raja Yoga bear in mind the one great and high purpose of his efforts, which should be the realization of his spiritual nature and the development of his individual self so that it finally merges into the spiritual self, thus gaining immortality in the flesh. Does this flesh mean the physical body? Not necessarily, because this that we see and name the physical body is not the real body, any more than the clothing that covers it is the person. Although frequently we recognize the acquaintances by their clothing, immortality in the flesh means cessation from further incarnations, the last and present personality including all others in consciousness, until we can say, I, manifesting in the physical as so-and-so, am now and forever immortal, remembering other manifestations which were not sufficiently complete, but which added to the sum of my consciousness until now I know myself a deathless being. To those who seek the path of Raja Yoga, we recommend meditation upon Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, of which there are several translations differing slightly as to interpretation. We have selected some of the most important from the translations by Johnston. They are designed to make clear the difference between the self of personality and the self or Atman which manifests in personality. The personal self seeks to feast upon life through a failure to perceive the distinction between the personal self and the spiritual man. All personal experiences really exist for the sake of another, namely the spiritual man. By perfectly concentrated meditation on experience for the sake of the self comes a knowledge of the spiritual man. The wise person seeks experience in order that he may attain to the standard of spiritual man, doing all things for the lessons they teach, working as those work who are ambitious and yet having no personal ambition, looking on all life and at the self of personality and knowing the illusion of the self. He is raising the personal self to the spiritual plane, but always he has the handicap of the desires of the lower self, the personal, which seeks to feast on life because it is born of the external and its inherent appetites are for the satisfaction and pleasures of that physical self. We do not say to look upon the body with its needs and its desires as an enemy to be overcome, or that its allurements are dangerous, although pleasurable. No, we say to the student, control the desires of the body. Make them do the bidding of the self, because it is only by so doing that you can gain the immortal heights of godhood. Looking down upon the fleeting dream of personality with its so-called pleasures as a bad nightmare compared to the joys that await the immortals. Therefore, concentrate upon experience for the sake of the self that you are, and learn the lesson of your experience, throwing aside the experience itself, as you would cast aside the skin of an orange from which the juice had been extracted. Don't fill the areas of your mortal mind with rubbish, with memories of benefits forgot, or loves unrequited, or friendships broken, or misspent hours, or unhallowed words and acts. Call from each day's experiences all that helps to develop the spiritual man, all that will stand the test of immortality. Kind words and deeds, principle maintained, a wrong forgiven, a service cheerfully extended, a tolerance and generosity for the mistakes of others as well as for your own. These seem small things to the personal self, the ambitious, the gloating, the sense-desiring self of the personality. We scarcely take them into account. But to the self that is seeking immortality, these are the grains of wheat from the load of chaff, the diamond in the carbon, the wings upon which the spirit soars to the realms of bliss. Meditate upon the sutra. By perfectly concentrated meditation upon the heart, The interior being comes the knowledge of consciousness. The heart is the guide of the inner nature, as the head is the outer. Love, the Most High God, is not born in the head but in the heart. The heart travails in pain, through sorrow and loss and compassion and pity and loneliness and aspiration and sensitiveness. And lo, there is born from this pain the spiritual self, which embraces the lesser consciousness, enfolding all your consciousness in the softness and bliss of pure seraphic love, the heritage of your immortality. Meditate long and wisely upon this sutra. Through perfectly concentrated meditation on the light in the head, come the visions of the masters who have attained, or through the divining power of intuition, he knows all things. There is a point in the head anatomically named the pineal gland. This is frequently alluded to as the seat of the soul, but the soul is not confined within the body. Therefore, it is in the nature of a key between the sense-conscious self and the spiritually conscious self. It is like a central receiving station and may be called up and aroused to consciousness by meditation. Realizing and focusing the light of the spiritual nature upon this part of the head opens up those unexplored areas of consciousness in which the masters dwell. And the student knows by intuition, which is a higher aspect of reason, many things which were heretofore incomprehensible to the merely sense-conscious man. The spiritual self is not a being unlike and wholly foreign to our concept of the perfect mortal man. All the powers of discernment which we find in mortal consciousness are accentuated, intensified, refined, all grossness, all imperfections and embarrassments removed, pleasure sensitized to ecstasy, love glorified to worship, shapeliness, beauty, force, the temper of the diamond, these are the endowments of that body. The spiritual body is shapely, strong, beautiful, imperishable as the diamond with all its brilliancy. No vapory, uncertain or unreal being, but the real with the husk of sense consciousness dropped off, and only the kernels of truth buried in the chaff of experience retained from the experiences of the personal self. When the spiritual man is perfectly disentangled from the psychic body, he attains to mastery over all things and to a knowledge of all. The spiritual self, the cosmic conscious self, must not be confounded with the psychic body, which is formed from the emotions, passions, fears, hatreds, ambitions, resentments, envy, regrets. Know thyself as a being superior to all baser emotions, and the mastery over them is complete. They are not destroyed, but converted into love, the everlasting source of life. There should be complete overcoming of allurement or pride in the invitations of the different regions of life, lest attachments to things evil arise once more. It is said that the disciples seeking the paths of yoga reach 3 degrees or stages of development. First, those who are just entering the path. Second, those who are in the realm of allurements, subject to temptations. Third, those who have won the victory over the senses and the external life, Maya. Fourth, those who are firmly entrenched behind the bulwark of certainty, the spiritual being realized, cosmic consciousness attained and retained. By absence of all self-indulgence at this point, also the seeds of bondage of sorrow are destroyed and pure spiritual being is attained. Self-abnegation and self-sacrifice have ever been the way of spiritual development, but we are prone to misunderstand and mistake the true interpretation of this admonition. Men shut themselves in monasteries and women become nuns and recluses as a penance, in order to purchase, as it were, absolution at oneness with the Absolute, which knows not sin. This is not the point intended here. Spiritual consciousness cannot be bought. The desires of the personal self may be sublimated into a divine force and power. Through recognizing the desires of the self as baubles, which attract and fill the eye until we fail to see the glories of that which awaits us. Thereafter, the whole personal being bends towards illumination, full of the spirit of eternal life. Here again, we have assurance that the spiritually conscious man, the luminous body, is not a being apart from the self that we know our inner nature to be, but rather it is the inner self, even as we in our ignorance and our lack of initiation know it, raised to a higher realm of consciousness our desires refined, spiritualized, made pure, and our faculties strengthened and immortalized. We do not withdraw from experience, but we draw from experience the lesson, the hidden wisdom of the initiate. Meditate upon these sutras. He who, after he has attained, is wholly free from self, is set in a cloud of holiness, which is called illumination. This is the true spiritual consciousness. This aphorism is self-explanatory. He who attends illumination and afterward lives and acts from the inner consciousness, the spiritual man, is free from the desires of the sense-conscious life. With its consequent disappointments, he sees everything from the spiritual rather than the mental point of view and understands the phrase, "And behold, all was good." Thereon comes success from sorrow and the burden of toil. The one who has attained cosmic consciousness, acting always from the self and not from personal desires, is set free from karma. He has fulfilled the cycle. He makes no more bondage for himself. He is free and is already immortal. When that condition of consciousness is reached, which is far-reaching and not confined to the body, which is outside the body and not conditioned by it, then the veil which conceals the light is worn away. The acquisition of spiritual consciousness, illumination, endows the mortal mind also with a degree of power sufficient to penetrate the veil of illusion, the Maya. The disciple then sees for the first time all things in their true light. The separation between the personal self and the spiritual being that we are is so fine as to be like a cobweb veil, and yet how few penetrate it. The suddenness with which this awakening, for it is like awakening from a dream of the senses, comes, startles, and surprises us, and then we become astonished at the transparency of the bonds that bound us to the limitations of the mortal. Then we might have soared to the realms of light. By perfectly concentrated meditation on the correlation of the body with the ether, and by thinking of it as light as thistle down, will come the power to traverse the ether. The Zen say that the way of the gods is through the air and afterwards in the ether. This means that we must evolve from the physical to the psychic and thence to the etheric or spiritual body. This is the way of the many. It is only the few who attain perfect spiritual consciousness while manifesting in the physical, but these do not have to undergo the second death, which is the dropping off of the psychic body and assuming the spiritual body. They attain to immortality in the flesh, i.e. in the present personality. Thereupon will come the manifestation of the atomic and other powers, which are the endowment of the body together with its unassailable force. The body here referred to, it must be borne in mind, is the etheric or spiritual body, which possesses the power to disintegrate matter, the power to annihilate time and space, so that he may look backward into remote antiquity and forward into boundless futurity, or as the commentator says, he can touch the moon with the tip of his finger, the power of levitation and limitless extension, the power of command, the power of creative will. These are the endowments of the spiritual body, with which the disciple is seeking to establish his identity, that he may overcome the second death and become immortal in consciousness here and now. Of this spiritual or etheric body it is said, fire burns it not, water wets it not, the sword cleaves it not, dry winds parch it not, it is unassailable. Meditate upon this sutra. For him who discerns between the mind and the spiritual man, the self, there comes perfect fruition of the longing after the real being. When the disciple has once grasped the fact that he is a soul and possesses a mind and a physical covering, he has entered on the way of illumination and must inevitably reach the goal. Then shall he find perfect fruition of the longing after the perfect self and its completement in union with the love that he craves. Have you, in lonely darkness, longed for companionship and consolation? You shall have angels and archangels for your friends and all the immortal hosts of the dawn. Such are the Yoga Sutras or aphorisms as enunciated by Patanjali. If the aspiring one were to give up a whole lifetime to their practice, gaining at last the consciousness of immortal life and love, what a small price to pay. Raja Yoga, with its methods and exercises, is the path of knowledge through application, concentration, meditation. The practice of Raja Yoga will lead the student to the path of Gnani Yoga and to the realization that Bhakti Yoga, the way of love and service, will be included. Not as an arduous task, not as a study or as a means to an end, but because of the love of it. Gnani Yoga comes as complementary to the practice of the sutras because knowledge applied for the purpose of spiritual attainment brings wisdom. Gnani Yoga, then, is the path of wisdom. The follower of Gnani Yoga seeks the occult or hidden wisdom and always has before him the idea of whether this or that be of the self, the Atman, or of the self, the personal, gradually eliminating from his desires all that does not answer the test of its reality in spiritual consciousness. He welcomes experiences of all kinds as so many lessons from which he extracts the fine grain of truth and throws aside the husks. He accepts nothing blindly or in faith, but proves all things holding fast to that which is good. Not that he lacks faith, but because the very nature of his inquiry is to discover the interior nature and its relation to God. There are many in the world today who feel the urge toward the path of Gnani Yoga. Because of the conviction that is forcing itself upon every truly enlightened mind, that civilization with all its wonderful achievements does not promise happiness or solve the question of the soul's urge. In short, the educated and the well-conditioned, if he be a thinker and not submerged in Maya, lost in the personal self, inevitably finds himself searching for the real in all his labyrinth of mind, creations, and sea of emotions. And then, as a rule, he seeks the path of Gnani Yoga because this intellect must be satisfied, even though his heart calls. The mystic, the teacher, and the philosopher are following the path of Gnani, so is the true occultist, but many who deal in the so-called occultism are employing knowledge only entirely missing the higher quality of wisdom. Bhakti Yoga, the path of self-surrender, thorny way through emotions, the blood of heart, is shortcut to illumination, if such a thing could be. But there is no shortcut, nor yet a long road. Someone has said, there are as many ways to God as there are souls, and yet all persons who are in the upward climb are demonstrating some of these four paths, or a combination of the paths. It is, however, a significant fact that we do not hear anything of the great intellectual attainment of the three great masters, Krishna, Buddha, and Jesus, but only of their great compassion, their wonderful love for mankind and all living things. St. Paul, who was probably an educated man, as he held a position of prominence among those in authority previous to his conversion, laid particular stress upon the love nature as the way of illumination. And Jesus repeatedly said, love is the fulfilling of the law. What is the law? The law of evolution and involution, of generation and regeneration, when the time should come that love was to reign on the planet Earth as it does in the heavens above the earth. Then should the kingdom of which he foretold be at hand, and in conclusion of this to be, Jesus promised that the law should be fulfilled when love should come. So Swami Vivekananda, in his exposition of Vedanta, declares, love is higher than work, than yoga, than knowledge. Day and night think of God in the midst of all your activities. The daily necessary thoughts can all be thought through God. Eat to him, drink to him, sleep to him, see him in all. Let us open ourselves to the one divine actor and let him act and do nothing ourselves. Complete self-surrender is the only way. Put out self, lose it, forget it. Let us substitute for the words God and him the one word love and see what it is we are told to do. Love of doing good frees us from work. Even though we labor from early dawn until the night falls, so too, if we have some loved one for whom we strive, we can endure every hardship with equanimity. As far as our own comfort is concerned, few human beings in the world today are so enmeshed in the personal self as to work merely for the gratification of selfish instincts. The hard-working man, whether laborer or banker, must have some sense for whom he struggles and strives, otherwise he descends to a level below that of the brute. This is the reason for the family, the lodge, the community, the nation. There must be some motive other than the preservation of the personal self in order to develop the higher quality of love which embraces the world until the spirit of a Christ takes possession of the human, and he would gladly offer himself a sacrifice to the world if by so doing he would eliminate all the pain from the world. How natural it is to feel. when we see a loved one suffering, that we would gladly take upon ourselves that pain. The heart fills with love until it aches with its burden of it. This love enlarged, expanded, and impersonal in its application is the same love with which we are told to love God and to do all for Him. Do all for love of all the other hearts in the universe that feel as we feel when they our loved ones suffer. That is the way to love God. It is the only way we know. We only know divine love through human love. Human love is divine when it is unselfish and eternal, not fed upon carnality but anchored in spiritual completement. The story of Abu Ben Adem, may his tribe increase, tells us how we may know who loves the Lord. The angel wrote the names of those who loved the Lord most faithfully and fully, and coming to Abu Ben Adem, asked if he should write his name, and received the reply that he could not say whether he deeply loved the Lord, but he was quite certain that the angel could write me as one who loves his fellow men. And lo, when the list was made and the names of all who loved the Lord recorded, Abu Ben Adem's name headed the list. The Vedanta philosophy teaches non-attachment, and Vivekananda himself says to love any one personality is bondage. Love all alike. Then all desires fall off. To love only the personal self or any one binds us to the sorrow of loss and separation and disappointment, but to love anyone spiritually is to establish a bond which can never be broken, which ensures union and defies time and space. We cannot love all alike, though we can love all humanity impersonally. All desires that we have their root in the sense-conscious plane of expression will fall off when the heart is anchored in spiritual love. But let it be understood that the spiritual love is not opposed to human love. We do not grow into spiritual love by denying the human, but by plussing the human. Spiritual consciousness is all that is good and pure and noble and satisfying in the mortal and infinitely more. It is the love of the personal self plus the self, the Atman. Love is never unrequited. It is never wasted, never foolish. Love is its own self-justification. If it be real love and not vanity or self-admiration misnamed, give it freely and don't ask for a return. Don't ask whither it leads, only ask if it is real, if the love you feel is for the object of your love, or if it is for yourself, for you to possess and to minister to your pleasure. Ask whether it is from the senses or from the heart. The way of the Bhakti Yoga is the way of love and service, because service to our fellow beings is the inevitable complement of love. Where we truly love, we gladly serve, it has been said. The chiefs tread a hairline. That is to say, the initiate must be prepared to meet defeat at every turn. Not defeat of his object of attainment, but the personal defeat that so many seek in the delusion that the world's ideal of success is the real success. In conclusion, we can only repeat what has been told and retold many times by all inspired ones of whatsoever creed and race, namely think and act always from the inner self, cheerfully taking the consequences of your choice. Let not the opinions of the illusory world of the senses balk and thwart you. Let not the worldly wise swerve you from your ideal and your faith in the final goal of your earthly pilgrimage, the attainment of spiritual consciousness in your present personality. This is the meaning of immortality in the flesh. Doubt not this. Make love your ideal, your guide, your final goal. Look for the inner self of all whom you meet. Learn to look into the hearts of men, says the injunction in Light on the Path. Dismiss from your mind all the accumulation of traditional concepts and prejudices that are not grounded in love. And above all, falter not nor doubt, no matter what seeming hardships you encounter in your earthly pilgrimage. They are but the Indian clubs of your soul's gymnasium. Experience. Meet with triumph and disaster and treat these two impostures just the same. Triumph and disaster, as seen with the eyes of sense consciousness, are both illusions. But don't for this reason cease your work. The phrase, you must work out your own salvation, is true. So also you must be willing to do your part in working out the salvation of the world. Salvation means simply the realization of the spiritual being that you are. The attainment of that state of illumination which guarantees immortality. Experience teaches one important lesson. Our sense-conscious life is filled with symbolic language if we have the inner eye of discernment. An unescapable truth is symbolized in our daily life by the evidence that we get nothing for nothing. Everything has its price. Immortality, godhood, will not be handed to you on a silver tray. Neither can anyone withhold it from you if you desire it above all things. And although it has its price, yet you cannot buy it. A seeming paradox, but the initiate will see it all clearly enough when the time comes. He who would scale the heights of understanding from whence the soul looks out forever free must falter not, nor fail, all truth demanding, though he bear the cross and know Gethsemane. The discouraged student says to himself, if truth demands such sorrow and sacrifice as this, I will not serve her. It is a false god that would so try his devotees. Have you not said it? The toll you pay is not the divine self within, but to the keepers of the threshold that guard the entrance to the dwelling place of the Illuminati. Earthly lodges and brotherhoods are symbols of the higher initiations. There is a common mistake in the idea that the invisible states of consciousness are chaotic or radically different from the visible. As below, so above, and as above, so below is an aphorism constantly held before the eyes of the would-be initiate, each of whom must interpret and know it for himself. If the student finds the Raja Yoga Sutras difficult of comprehension or of practice, let him meditate upon the following mantras. I know myself to be above the false concepts which assail the personal self that I appear to be. I am united with the all-seeing, all-knowing consciousness. I abide in the consciousness of the indestructibility and omniscience of being. I rest secure and content in the integrity of cosmic law, which shall lead my soul unto its own, guaranteeing immortal love. I unite myself with that power that makes for righteousness. Therefore, nothing shall dismay or defeat me, because I am at one with the limitless areas of spiritual consciousness. My mind is the dynamic center through which my soul manifests the love which illumines the world. Only good can come to the world through me. Much that is called mental science or new thought in Christian science has for its aim and ideal avoidance of all that does not make for personal well-being and worldly success. Avoid this ideal, distrust this motive. Be ever willing to sacrifice the personal self to the real self if need be. If the ideal is truly the desire for illumination and not for self-gratification, the mind will soon learn to distinguish between the lesser and the greater. Have you longed for perfect, satisfying human love? You shall have it plus 1,000-fold in immortal spiritual union with your God. We have set forth only a few of the facts and instances which the inquirer will find if he but seek, of the reality of a superconscious faculty no less actual than are the faculties of the sense-conscious human, which type forms the average of the race. This faculty, or rather we should say these faculties, because they find expression in many ways, through avenues correlative to the physical senses, prove the existence of a realm of consciousness far above the planes of the mortal or sense-conscious man, and transcending the region known as the astral and psychic areas of consciousness. All who have reported their experiences in contacting this illimitable region unite in the essential points of experience, namely, the experience is indescribable. It confers an unshakable conviction of immortality. It discloses the fact that we are now living in this superconscious realm that is not something which we acquire after death. It is not to be. This realm is characterized by a beautiful, wonderful, radiant, iridescent light. O green fire of life, pulse of the world, O love. It fills the heart with great and all-embracing love, establishing a realization of the silent brotherhood of the cosmos, demolishing all barriers of race and color and class and condition. Illumination is inclusive. It knows no separation. It announces the fact that every person is right from his point of view, that nothing walks with aimless feet, that no one life shall be destroyed or cast as rubbish on the void when God hath made the pile complete, that life and love and joy unutterable are the reward of the seeker, and that there is no one and only path. All systems are creeds, all methods that are formulated and upheld by altruism are righteous, and that the real is the spiritual. The external is a dream from which the world is awakening to the consciousness of the spiritual man, the Atman, the self that is ageless, birthless, deathless, divine. On all sides are evidences that the race is entering upon this new consciousness. So many are weary with the strife and struggle and noise of the sense-conscious life, the illusions of possessions which break in our hands as we grasp them, of empty titles of so-called honor, built upon prowess in war, the feverish race after wealth, cold as the marble palaces which it builds to shut in its worshippers. All these things are becoming skeleton-like and no longer deceive those who are even remotely discerning the new birth. The new heraldry will have for its badge of royalty love and service to my fellow beings, displacing the Doemon Dra of the ancient ideal. The dawn is here. Are you awake? And thus we conclude this episode, The Way of Illumination, Awakening the Man-God Within, a collection of different chapters from the book, The Way of Illumination and Cosmic Consciousness, The Man-God Whom We Await, The Lives of Prophetic and Spiritual Figures, Ancient and Modern. It's a great book. Definitely check out the other chapters. But it is amazing what he is talking about here. Completely syncs with Neville Goddard material, the Joseph Murphy material. Really, an explanation coming from the perspective of a sort of Mason, that we are God, that we're awakening to our Godhood, that there is an illumination that can occur. And as he references multiple different people in our history, we can awaken ourselves. We can come into reference to this light that can change our world. And if enough people are awakened as referenced in this material, then we can experience the new earth and the new heaven spoken of in the Bible. One at a time, as we awaken and are illumined, as we follow these principles, as we learn how to think properly, which is Raja Yoga, as we learn the lessons of the heart, Gnani Yoga and Bhakti Yoga, which are lessons of power and understanding. And as we learn these lessons and we move to a level of service, of selflessness, as we move in this transition, we become illumined in a way that changes everything. And he refers to Moses and Buddha and a variety of other spiritual teachers that have had the same experience, and gives examples of this wonderful experience. It's indescribable. It cannot be described in words. And if you purely had it, you probably wouldn't be able to experience it in your regular body. But we get glimpses of it in this life. And it's a way of living, a way of thinking, a way of doing, a way of being. So I'd love to get your thoughts on yet another book in the New Thought Library that we are creating on the Reality Revolution podcast. Ollie Nomad was the name given in the book, but the actual writer was Alexander McIver Tyndall, who is a very interesting character. And I would love to get your feelings about this work. Doesn't it feel inspired? It really does. I am imagining wonderful things for everybody that can hear my voice, and hoping that you have a fantastic day. Let me know what you think. And if I can find more like this, I will. I know that you'll be illuminated soon if you're not already, and you've seen the light, and tell me about it if you did. All episodes of The Reality Revolution can be found at therealityrevolution.com. And welcome to The Reality Revolution.